Redeemer Adult Education presents Dr. Jeffrey Beshears speaking on the life and works of C.S. Lewis, A Mere Christian. In session one, he discusses the formative years. It was recorded on June 5th, 2011 in Rudisill Hall at the Lutheran Church of the Redeemer in Midtown Atlanta, Georgia.
Welcome to the first of four series on the life and writings of C.S. Lewis, who arguably was the most important Christian writer of the 20th century. And I think very few people would disagree with that. Our guest speaker for these four sessions is Dr. Jeffrey Beshears. And Dr. Beshears is a Christian scholar, a Christian history scholar. He stays quite busy when he's not teaching, writing. And he writes on Christian history, apologetics, cultural issues, and other topics related to contemporary Christianity. So, without further introduction, and by the way, as an aside, he's for many years been a very close personal friend, so we're really happy to have him with us, and his wife Dolly is here with him today, so introduce yourself to her too. So, okay, Jen.
Well, thank you, Dave, and it's certainly nice to be with you all. I've been very much looking forward to this. Let's see. Typical absent-minded professor. Has anybody seen my glasses? If I could see well enough, I could probably find them. Oh, there they are. What a strange coincidence that they're right there on my person. But I've been looking forward to it. Now, typically, this is about a 12-hour course, and I understand we have to be out by, what, at least 6 this evening or something like that, so I'm not sure we can get it all in, but we'll try to use the time as wisely as possible. What I thought we'd do, since, again, it's a rather elongated course on the life and works of C.S. Lewis, I thought this morning we'd take a look at the early life and some of the formative experiences of C.S. Lewis. Next week, we'll focus exclusively on his conversion, which is really a pretty fascinating story. And then that'll leave two more sessions where we can look at his works, in particular Mere Christianity, maybe devote an entire session to Mere Christianity. By the way, that's about a 25-hour study in itself. But we'll try to summarize some of the major themes in Mere Christianity, our third session, and then the fourth session maybe deal with some of his other works as well, primarily his theological and apologetical works. So, again, it's nice to be with you. I assume everyone has gotten a copy of the handouts up here. We have a two-sided chronology, very brief outline chronology of Lewis's life. And you see there in the right-hand column some of his major publications as well. And we'll allude to those again over the next several weeks. And then an anecdote from his life that I like to refer to from time to time entitled Encountering the Great Knock. And we'll try to climax our discussion this morning by referencing that. So, C.S. Lewis, I refer to him as a mere Christian. He certainly was not an average Christian, but he was a mere Christian as he defined it. And in that sense, it's a little bit analogous to Watchman Nee. Many of you may be familiar with Watchman Nee's writings, in particular his book, The Normal Christian Life. And his point was that a normal Christian life is certainly anything but the average Christian life, but it is normal in that it conforms closely to a discipleship perspective in terms of following Jesus Christ. So C.S. Lewis, a mere Christian, certainly not an average Christian. Now, How many of you have read substantively on Lewis's life, a major biography or or so on. Okay, so there are a few. And, of course, there have been numerous biographies on Lewis written. One of my favorites, and in fact, I think it's generally considered now to be pretty much the standard one-volume biography of Lewis, is the work by George Sayer. The title is Jack, A Life of C.S. Lewis. So if you're looking for one in particular that probably is the most representative, this is the one that I would recommend. Now, Lewis, of course, was a renowned lecturer and a tutor in literature at Oxford University and at Cambridge University. He taught for over 30 years, and actually for his first 30 years or so, he taught at Oxford at Magdalen College. Now, in America, we pronounce that Magdalen as in Mary Magdalene, named after Mary Magdalene. In England, they refer to it as Magdalen College. And there's a Magdalen College at Oxford University, and that's where C.S. Lewis taught for his first 30 years of his career. Then he was given a professorship at Magdalen College, another Magdalen College associated with Cambridge University, and that's where he taught his last 5 or 6 years. And in that second phase of his career at Cambridge University, he was a professor of medieval and Renaissance literature. Now, that's after he had established his reputation as a great Christian scholar and a great Christian thinker. Interestingly, for most of his career, he was not a professor. In fact, he didn't even have a doctorate degree. He was actually just a lecturer and a tutor. And now his lectures were among the most popular courses on campus on a regular basis, but he was not a professor until those last several years of his career when Cambridge University, Oxford's competitor, offered him a professorship. Now, he's generally recognized as one of the 20th century's most gifted and prolific writers. He was absolutely a first-rate scholar. He's, of course, a Christian apologist, one who's very adept at defending the truth claims, the unique truth claims of the Christian faith. He was a poet. In fact, early in life, that he was actually aspiring to be a major poet. It turns out that his skills and his gifts as a poet were not as formidable as otherwise, and so he was deterred rather early on by negative criticism regarding his poetry, and he turned his attention more to just mainline scholarship instead. But he's a Christian apologist, he's a poet, a science fiction writer. He's the author, of course, of children's fantasy novels, the Chronicles of Narnia series and the Space Trilogy. And he certainly at times could write with great charm, great wit, great insight, and certainly occasional eloquence as well. Now, he was very much disinterested in impressing the academic elite of his day, the literati of his day. And in fact, Lewis will write specifically and intentionally for the common man. He writes in a very conversational, first-person tone in many of his writings. So he's not interested in impressing his academic colleagues. And in some respects, this certainly sets him apart from the mainstream in academia, who normally are writing to impress, again, their peers, their colleagues, and so on, and actually have sort of a snobbish attitude when it comes to writing in such a way that would appeal to the common, you know, masses of people. And but Lewis was different in that respect. And, of course, his influence far exceeds all of his academic peers. Now, although he writes for the common layman, he certainly doesn't pander to his audience. In fact, he writes with great incisive profundity. And Mere Christianity, which is more or less sort of an informal primer, you might say, in Christian apologetics. In other words, what Christians traditionally have believed and why the unique truth claims of the Christian faith are defensible rationally and factually. Mere Christianity is arguably the most significant and the most influential Christian book of the 20th century. And 42 years after his death, 36 of his books are still in publication and have sold over 250 million copies worldwide. Now, and by the way, this was before the release back in, I think it was 2004, of the movie versions of the Chronicles of Narnia. And of course, those have driven his book sales even higher. So he's probably up close to 300 million books sold based on recent interest in his life and works. Now, Lewis is certainly one of the great Christian thinkers of the 20th century. It's interesting, see, he's not a professional philosopher. He did get a master's degree in philosophy. He actually got three master's degrees. One was in philosophy, but he was not a professional philosopher. He was not a professional theologian. He's not a professional Bible scholar. He's not actually a historian. He's certainly not a psychologist. He's not a social scientist. But when he writes in all of these fields, he writes with amazing perceptivity. And again, sort of a rarity among intellectuals, he reconciles and balances reason and imagination, I think, about as well as any author certainly I've ever encountered. He understood that when it comes, when taken to extremes, reason can lead to rationalism. And when taken to extremes, imagination can lead to romanticism or to escapism, basically. So, again, he reconciles, integrates, and balances both reason and the imagination, and does it, I think, in a generally successful and sometimes absolutely brilliant manner. Now, in the year 2000, the Christianity Today magazine voted Mere Christianity the most influential Christian book of the 20th century. And by the way, the second book on their list of top 100 most influential books, number one was Mere Christianity. Can you imagine what number two might have been? Screwtape Letters. And I don't know if you've mentioned it or not, Dave, but there is the stage show of Screwtape Letters that's coming to Atlanta this week. I think it's, from Thursday through the weekend or something? Thursday through Sunday, okay. So highly recommended. I assume there probably still are tickets available. Now, in 2002, one of the most popular courses at Harvard University was a course entitled Sigmund Freud and C.S. Lewis, Two Contrasting Worldviews. And this is a course that was taught by Dr. Armand Nicolai of the Harvard Medical School. And the seminar was so popular that only about one-fourth of the students who registered were actually admitted into the class for space purposes. In 2004, that course that Dr. Nicolai taught became the basis for a PBS documentary, The Question of God. Did anyone get an opportunity to see that on PBS? It's aired several times since 2004. Fascinating program. It has a lot of dramatic recreations of both Lewis and Sigmund Freud's lives, and then also sort of a roundtable seminar discussion among some scholars comparing and contrasting the lives of those two men. And again, they're contrasting and in many respects diametrically opposite worldviews. Fascinating. It's available at PBS still if you're interested. It's called The Question of God. Then in 2005, the film version of the first of Lewis's Narnia books, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, debuted. It became one of the most successful books of the year. And then in terms of his personality and character, C.S. Lewis is certainly an interesting character and oftentimes a rather interesting study in contrast. The man has a first-rate mind. And he's a very astute and a very engaging conversationalist. As a teacher and a tutor, he was very direct, no nonsense. At times, he could be very confrontational, but he could also be quite kind and generous and certainly intellectually stimulating. Now, he was not particularly popular among his Oxford colleagues, and I think you could probably imagine why. His popularity and his influence probably far exceeded the collective popularity and influence of all the rest of his colleagues, and there was a tremendous amount of academic jealousy directed toward him. He was maligned, he was satirized, he was criticized roundly, and was never really accepted as part of the inner circle of the Oxford academic community, which is why, again, later in his career, he willingly accepted another position at Cambridge University. He had grown very, very tired of all the campus politics at Oxford and all the bigotry and discrimination directed toward him and a handful of other Christian academics there at Oxford. Now, in terms of personality, Lewis, again, very straightforward, very abrupt, and as I said, at times confrontational. He certainly could be argumentative, and among those who were subjected to his interrogation and paired up with him in debates, many of them thought that he could be an intellectual bully. But he certainly was a man who had a robust joy in living. He could be very, very loud, very boisterous, very, very coarse, very chauvinistic, heavy drinker, a constant chain smoker. He smoked two packs of cigarettes a day, in addition to several lightings of his pipe. And also, again, quite a heavy drinker. In fact, one of his biographers, A.N. Wilson, writes that Lewis was impatient with Puritanism and disliked non-smokers and teetotalers. In fact, many of you probably remember this from his books, Mere Christianity. In Mere Christianity, Lewis refers to Islam as the teetotaler's religion. And in truth, the man must have smelled like a beer-soaked ashtray. But a man who lives life with great gusto and a formidable influence. Now, Lewis's papers are and his memorabilia are housed in a couple of different locations. There's a major archival collection of Lewis's works at the Wade Collection at Wheaton College, up outside of Chicago. And then there's another major collection of his works and memorabilia at Oxford University under the direction of Walter Hooper. Walter Hooper was an early keeper of the C.S. Lewis legacy and has done probably more than anyone else to perpetuate Lewis's influence and legacy through the years. Now, what accounts for Lewis's sustained popularity through the decades? One of his biographers, Lewis Marcos, has written that it's no exaggeration to say that every modern Christian apologist has been influenced in some way by C.S. Lewis. Some of his basic arguments for the integrity and the truth of the Christian faith are still used by first-rate apologists today. And in some respects, C.S. Lewis sort of stands as an everyman of the modern age. In his life, his spiritual pilgrimage was basically an existential journey through many of the major ideological themes of the 20th century. Now, Lewis begins his life in a nominal Christian home, and so the first phase of his spiritual journey, you might say, he is a nominal Christian, a Christian in name only. He never actually ever enjoyed going to church. He never really took what he learned in church very seriously as a child and an adolescent. And But he was forced to go. Actually, his mother's father, his maternal grandfather, was a very prominent pastor in Belfast, where he grew up. And so, by necessity, Lewis showed up in church every Sunday. By the way, his grandfather was known for two things. The man was exceedingly emotional. He would oftentimes break down in tears in his sermons. Get just very, very passionate. And this, of course, was a great embarrassment to the family. And it was certainly a great embarrassment to Lewis and his brother Warren or Warney to see their grandfather on a regular basis break down in tears in public. And you know, his biographers, especially his psychobiographers, tell us that you know, certainly was an influence in terms of him adopting a very stoic, reserved, you know, persona, sort of an aversion to the excessive emotionalism of his grandfather. Now, his grandfather was also known for one other factor. Of course, growing up in Belfast, Northern Ireland, there was this stark division between Protestants and Catholics. There was a tremendous amount of tension and a lot of animosity and, frankly, just outright loathing and hatred between the two. And his grandfather was one of the foremost proponents of a militant Protestantism. He truly believed that Catholics were the devil's children, and he preached this on a regular basis. And you can see that later in his life, when he becomes a Christian, this is an influence on Lewis as well. His aversion to that kind of bigotry and prejudice on the part of his grandfather is a major factor, I think, in Lewis embracing a broad, you know, inclusive Christianity. Or as he liked to describe himself, he was a great tradition Christian. And he was very much opposed to excessive identification with denominations and particular theological systems. So he sees himself as a, quote, mere Christian or a general or basic Christian and a great tradition Christian. But anyway, he grows up as a nominal Christian. Now, he goes from that, by the time he's about 12 or 13 years old, he has become a materialistic skeptic. In other words, he's virtually become an atheist. Now, I know some of you are somewhat aware of his life, and can you connect the two themes here, the two dots? What is it that drives him away from any sort of identification with Christianity to the point where he becomes virtually an atheist? Does anyone remember from... Yes, well, that's a major factor. When he's 9 years old, his mother dies. It's a very traumatic experience because he's never had a very close relationship with his father. He considers his father to be a bit of a tyrant, and his father apparently has a rather explosive personality. So Lewis's refuge from the wrath of his father in his own household would be, you know, his mother. Now, she wasn't particularly tender, and she didn't possess a whole lot of motherly sympathy either. But by comparison to his father, you know, she at least sheltered him to some extent. Now, she dies when he's 9 years old. And he tells us in his autobiography, Surprised by Joy, that he had prayed very earnestly for his mother's healing, of course, but to no avail. And she does die. And then almost immediately after her death, he is shipped off to a boarding school in a foreign country. Now, this foreign country is England, but that is a foreign country if you grew up in Ireland, even Northern Ireland. So he's sent to a foreign country sent to a boarding school that turns out to be an extremely harsh, authoritarian, repressive school in which there's a tremendous amount of abuse going on, not just mental, emotional abuse, but outright physical abuse, primarily on the part of the headmaster of that school. Now, by the way, the headmaster was a former Presbyterian minister who... still claimed to be a Christian, of course. And oftentimes when he's abusing and beating the children, he'll be quoting Bible verses in the process. So this is another factor, of course, that's going to drive Lewis away from any sort of identification with the Christian faith. And by the time he's a teenager, he's basically defining himself, describing himself as an atheist. Now, the next phase in his spiritual journey goes from virtual atheism to what I would call romantic idealism. And if you're, you know, familiar with the psychology of atheism, if you've studied some Christian apologetics, I think you can, again, sort of see the connection here. Atheism is a very bleak, cynical worldview. It holds absolutely no hope whatsoever for any meaning and purpose in life. And so those who gravitate toward that perspective oftentimes find that it's an unbearable worldview in which to operate. And so they'll desperately reach out for other alternatives. And in the case of Lewis, he desperately wanted to believe that there's, if there is no absolute meaning and value in life, at least perhaps we could create it on our own accord. Sort of an existential orientation. And he becomes very entranced by romantic literature and begins to identify with that strand of literature more than anything else because it's a very nice escape from the harsh realities that characterize, you know, his life at this time. He's in his teenage years. He's, of course, a very bright boy. Because he's not very popular with his peers, he's not an athlete. In fact, he has no athletic talents whatsoever. And he's not a musician or anything like that. And so he sort of carves out a self-identity as a serious student. And he begins reading prolifically. In fact, by the time he's 9 years old, he's reading works like John Milton's Paradise Lost. And in fact, if you look at a list of books he had read by the time he was about 10 years old, it far exceeds what most college students have read, you know, up to that point in their life. So he finds some sort of escape in romantic idealism. This opens him up to the possibility that there is a realm of reality beyond just the physical and the material. Now, unfortunately, the next step in his spiritual journey certainly doesn't take him anywhere near Christianity, but it does take him into the realm of the supernatural. And he begins to identify and become very transfixed, you might say, with the occult. And in this case, a particular aspect of the occult called theosophy. Oops, I blew the spelling there. Theosophy, occultism. And, you know, if we were mapping out a spiritual journey for a child, a grandchild, or somebody that we really cared about, somebody who had a very hardcore, negative, pessimistic view toward life, very staunchly agnostic or atheistic, if we wanted to open them up to the reality that there is a spiritual dimension to life, we probably would not recommend that you first take a detour through the occult. I mean, it can be a dead end, literally a dead end, a very evil realm of reality. But in Lewis's case, it actually is, strangely enough, you might say sort of a step in the right direction because it does get him out of his hardcore naturalistic, materialistic point of view, and it opens him up to the realization that there is a spiritual and a supernatural realm of life. Now, from occultism, which, by the way, after dabbling in it rather briefly, he realized it's really a horrific worldview. And so he was quite eager to leave it behind and move on. And in this case, he begins to adopt sort of a pantheistic worldview. He does believe that there is a spiritual, supernatural realm of reality. But for a while, he's reading a lot of Vedic and Hindu literature, and he becomes, for a few years there, sort of a devotee of the pantheistic worldview that everything in life is imbued by supernatural powers and spirits and so on. Now, it doesn't take a whole lot of thinking about pantheism before you realize that it's a very deficient perspective on reality. And so he will transition then from pantheism to, in Christian theology, what we would call Manichaeism, this idea that there certainly is a supernatural realm and there are evil forces and there are good forces, and these evil and good forces are more or less equally powerful. And so in Christian history, we call that Manichaeism. And that's the term I'll use here, Manichaeism or Manichaeanism. Again, there are certain powers in nature that are particularly potent. And see, Lewis can't see that the powers for good are superior to the powers for evil. So in his mind, it's a very dualistic worldview system. And of course, there's so much evil and suffering in this world, so the powers of evil must be very, very strong. And yet there's also great beauty and great goodness in this world as well. So obviously there is some sort of a positive operating factor behind the scenes. Now, being an astute thinker, he understands after a while that Manichaeism is also very, very deficient. In other words, it philosophically doesn't really make sense. And so the next step is a general embracing of theism. The worldview perspective that would hold that there is a great creator God who created everything that exists, ex nihilo, and this God, to some extent or another, supervises and sustains the universe. Now, it's not quite to the point of being Christianity yet, but he has thoroughly renounced his earlier materialistic atheism. And by the time he's about 30 years old, he is declaring himself to be a believer in God. Now, the question would be, of course, there are various forms of theism, various religions and cults and all that are theistic. So which is the most valid? And he spends the next 3 years of his life exploring in great detail the various theistic options before he finally comes to a realization that the only system, the only belief system that makes real sense, and furthermore, the only belief system that has strong historical evidence behind it, is Christian theism, biblically based theism. And so, of course, that will be his final, you might say, final position in his spiritual journey. And we'll spend our time next week actually looking at his Christian conversion. As I said, it's really a fascinating story, very, very inspiring. And I'm very much looking forward to sharing some of that with you. But let me just pause at this point and see if you might have any comments or questions on any of this before we move on. Yes, please. In England and back in Northern Ireland, deplorable. It's been so co-opted, so corrupted by theological liberalism. The tide of the culture has turned against the church. And so the church does not have a whole lot to offer in terms of presenting a real strong example of Christian truth. So I'm glad you asked the question, because this is more or less a solitary journey on Lewis's part. He gets very, very little support, well, certainly no support from the clergy of the day. Now, that's not to say that there weren't those around who could have helped him greatly. But he gets no support from the clergy of his day. He gets only a modicum of support from a very small number of academics, colleagues, and so on. It's basically a solitary journey, spiritual journey. You might find this interesting. Lewis, after he became a Christian, he understood that he needed to go to church. He understood that there was great value in that discipline. That's a spiritual discipline, and that it's absolutely imperative. Having said that, he never really enjoyed it, and he only went because he knew again that it is an imperative discipline on our part. There is something intrinsically spiritually edifying about it. But he deplored church music, could not stand it, and found most sermons to be anything but inspiring. So he doesn't get a whole lot of support in that realm. Now, later he did develop a very close relationship with the pastor of a local Anglican church, and they became very, very good friends, and he certainly got a lot of spiritual support and encouragement from that man. But
you really have a very, very intelligent person seeking for something and not getting any help.
Right.
Yeah,
you're right. I mean, he is extraordinarily intelligent. There's no question about that. He has a very, very active mind. He has an absolute obsession with acquiring knowledge. I mean, real knowledge. You know, the only real knowledge is truth, isn't it? It's truth-based knowledge. Everything else is actually anti-knowledge, if you think about it, or pseudo-knowledge. And he cares nothing about pseudo-knowledge. He really is from the time he's 12, 13 years old, I mean, he is on a spiritual quest. He doesn't realize it for several years, but he is a sincere seeker after truth. And God richly guides and provides for him. It's a long, circuitous route, and it's a rather torturous journey in many respects. But eventually, the grace of God is manifest, and it's a remarkable conversion story. Yes, please.
Is that an England Christian?
Yes. In 1932, when Lewis was a young tutor lecturer at Oxford, he started meeting with two or three colleagues who were Christians. One was J.R.R. Tolkien. Another one was his brother, Warren. Warren was not an academic, but Warren was living with Jack at the time. And then there were one or two other Christians. Now, it was a pretty broad-based, eclectic little group, theologically and in every other respect. But his little social group, the Inklings, they would get together once or twice a week, do a lot of drinking, a lot of smoking, and a lot of theologizing. And they do provide a lot of support for one another. Tolkien was a conservative Catholic, and at first Lewis was quite put off by that. Now, again, Lewis doesn't share the prejudices of his grandfather, but he's still very uneasy around Catholics. But eventually he grows to respect Tolkien quite a lot. And then there are others that may be familiar names to you, Hugo Dyson and Owen Barfield and people like that, who become part of his inner circle, this group that they called themselves the Inklings, because they were all writers. They were all thinkers and writers. And they would get together and share their latest essays and so on and critique one another. And by the way, this was not a warm and fuzzy little mutual admiration society. When somebody read a paper or something he'd recently read, he was opening himself up to some rather stark criticism, and they didn't hold back. They understood that the best way to help somebody is to challenge them on every point and really sharpen their thinking and their skills and so on. So it was sort of a rough and tumble group. And in fact, over the years, some of the people involved in the Inklings, eventually it reached a point where so many egos were bruised that people did begin sort of dropping out. And eventually, Lewis and Tolkien were the only two left in the group. And you might find this interesting. At that point, this is the late 1940s, and Lewis is working on what will become the Chronicles of Narnia, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Now, just for emphasis' sake. And now, by this point, Tolkien has already finished The Lord of the Rings. And everybody concedes that this is an absolutely brilliant work of creativity. Now, Lewis starts writing The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And Tolkien is totally unimpressed. He thinks it's really second-rate fantasy literature. For one thing, he really objected to the mythological syncretization that Lewis was employing. See, if you read Tolkien's work, you can almost imagine that this actually takes place at some distant time in the past, some distant civilization or whatever. Now, Lewis's is very syncretistic, and Tolkien didn't like that at all. He didn't feel like it worked. And so Tolkien was an honest guy, and he couldn't hold back. And he let Lewis know that he didn't think this was very good at all. And it really hurt Lewis's feelings. And actually, it was a major factor in the two of them. Their friendship eventually sort of broke apart as well. And it's not long after that that, the love of Lewis's life comes into his life, Joy Davidman Gresham. And she becomes, of course, the focus of his relationship attentions from that point on. But the Inklings were a factor early on. They stimulated, they provoked, they challenged one another. And we could all use people like that, couldn't we, in our lives? It's just a matter of setting aside one's ego so that you can receive the truth, whether it's conveyed in a real warm and fuzzy way or whether it's conveyed rather harshly. I mean, it doesn't really matter, does it, if it's the truth? Okay. I think there was one other... yes, please.
Where was your sequence was World War I?
World War I would have come in this phase. Let me think here now. World War I, okay, he's going to be about 18. So he's sort of transitioning from being a very proud... atheist to being more of a romantic idealist at that point. Yeah. So it's during sort of a transition period in his life. Mm-hmm. It'll be after the war that he first encounters the occult and the subsequent stages. Yeah. Anything else? Yes, please.
Did he have brothers, sisters?
He had one brother. His brother's name was Warren. Commonly called Warrenie. Warren was a pretty bright guy, but not on Lewis's level. Warren has a lifelong problem with alcoholism. And, of course, there's alcohol being consumed constantly in the Lewis home and so on, and must have been just a constant temptation. But Warrenie's life is kind of a tragic life in many respects. But after C.S. Lewis dies, Warren does live a few more years, and he does sort of collect the papers of Lewis and preserve sort of the Lewis legacy and writes quite a lot on Lewis's life. So he does make a contribution, but I think he always thought that his own life was disappointing and never really lived up to his potential. Yes?
Lewis read Chester.
Yes, he did. And reading G.K. Chesterton was one of the formative influences on his eventual conversion to Christianity. G.K. Chesterton, writing in the early 20th century, was probably the foremost Christian apologist of the day. And Lewis read him, was very impressed by his arguments. And in fact, Lewis will incorporate a lot of Chesterton's arguments into some of his early apologetical work. Now, as far as I know, they never actually met, but Chesterton was influential. Now, when we look at the spiritual journey and also the intellectual maturation of C.S. Lewis, one anecdote that always stands out in my mind is his encounter with his father's former tutor. His father had received a private tutorial education for several years under a man named William Kirkpatrick, whom they called the Great Knock. And Lewis, as I said, had been sent off to a very harsh, oppressive English boarding school when he was only 9 years old. He lasted about a year there, and then he begged his father to transfer somewhere else. So his father put him in another school. It turned out to be better, but it was still a social environment in which Lewis was very, very uncomfortable. Again, he didn't relate well at all to his peers. And so by the time he was about 14 or so, at Lewis's constant prodding, his father finally agreed to allow him to study under his father's former tutor, William Kirkpatrick. And this was a means by which Lewis could study extensively for a couple of years and then take his college entrance exams and hopefully get into a prestigious college or university. And of course, that is how it turned out. Now, the anecdote that I'm referring to here is the one that is included in the handout here, which hopefully you have or have access to it. And let's go through that, and let me sort of set the stage here. Now, as I said, Lewis has been very, very unhappy in his school life up to this point. His father finally relents and allows to let him study under William Kirkpatrick. And so Kirkpatrick lives in a section of Surrey, England, in a little village called Great Bookham. And Kirkpatrick, of course, is going to be charged with preparing Lewis for entry into the university. Now, Lewis had heard about the Great Knock all of his life, and he thought he had a very clear impression of what he was in for. And it's actually kind of ironic and humorous, because see, out of all his out of all that his father had told him about the Great Knock, one little anecdote stood out in Lewis's young mind. He remembered his father mentioning on one occasion about how he was struggling academically in a particular area, and how on this one occasion, Kirkpatrick had taken him aside and comforted him and even gave him a tender little hug and whispered a few comforting words in his ear. Well, now, the reason his father, you know, had mentioned that is because it, frankly, was so unusual. And Lewis, though, thinks that's how this man is, that he's going to be like a kindly, grandfatherly figure, and or as Lewis says, I imagined him to be an arch sentimentalist, who again a man who would be warm and cuddly and very eager to greet him with open arms. So that's sort of the backdrop here for encountering the Great Knock. So let me make sure that we end at the correct time. Quarter till 11. Okay, good. So let's work through this together. Now, as I say there, at this point in his autobiography, Lewis is 15 years old. He's just left boarding school. He's traveled by train to meet his new private tutor, William Kirkpatrick, under whom his father had studied many years earlier. And this is how Lewis relates the initial meeting. It says, quote, "Now at Bookham, I was met by my new teacher, Kirk, or the Great Knock, as my father and I called him. Now, I'd heard about him all my life, and I therefore thought that I had a very clear impression of what I was in for. He was over 6 feet tall, very shabbily dressed, somewhat like a gardener, I thought." Lewis says, the Great Knock used to be a Presbyterian pastor years ago. And Lewis says, he tells us later, that even though Kirkpatrick was now a very militant atheist, he hadn't totally shed the Christian influences of the past. For instance, when he went out to work in his garden on Sundays, he dressed slightly nicer than he did the rest of the week. Perhaps he put on a tie or something, you know. He says, we shook hands, and though his grip was like iron pincers, it was not lingering, so at least he didn't crush his hand. A few minutes later, we were walking away from the station. You are now, said Kirk, proceeding through the main artery between Great and Little Bookham, two sections, you know, of the town. Now, I stole a glance at him, and I began to, quote, make conversation in the deplorable manner which I had acquired at evening parties, you know, chit-chat. I said I was surprised at the scenery around Surrey because it was a lot wilder than I had expected. Stop! Shouted Kirk with a suddenness that made me jump. What do you mean by wildness, and what grounds have you for not expecting it? I replied that I didn't know what grounds there were, and he continues chattering on, making conversation. As answer after answer was torn to shreds, it at last dawned upon me that he actually really wanted to know. He was not just making conversation. He was not joking, nor was he snumming me. He wanted to know. And I was stung into attempting a real answer. Now, a few passes suffice to show that I really had no clear and distinct idea corresponding to the word wildness, and that insofar as I had any idea at all, wildness was a totally inept word. Do you not see then, concluded the great Knock, that your remark was meaningless? Now, I prepared to sulk. I mean, here he's 15 years old. I mean, what 15-year-old wouldn't be prepared to sulk? He's just been embarrassed. So I prepared to sulk, assuming that the subject would be dropped. Never was I more mistaken. Having analyzed my terms, Kirk was proceeding to deal with my proposition as a whole. Now, on what had I based? Of course, the way Kirk pronounced it, on what had I based my expectations about the flora and the geology of Surrey? Was it maps? Had I been studying maps or photographs or books? But of course, I could produce none. It had, heaven help me, never occurred to me that what I called my thoughts needed to be based on anything. They're just opinions, right? One person's opinion is as good as another, right? No. Kirk once more drew a conclusion without the slightest sign of emotion, but equally without the slightest concession to what I thought good manners. Do you not see, then, that you had no right to have an opinion whatsoever on the subject? Now, by this time, our acquaintance had lasted about 3.5 minutes. But the tone was set by this first conversation, and it was preserved without a single break during all the years I spent at Bookham. The most casual remark was taken as a summons to debate or a summons to disputation. You can't get away with anything around this guy. As Brother Warney once remarked, you couldn't casually mention the weather without being challenged on it around Kirkpatrick. Now,
what I like so much about this anecdote, just imagine how shocked this 15-year-old boy must have been by this initial encounter at the train station.
He meets this man who's exceedingly eccentric, very shabbily dressed. See, Lewis thought that smart people, intellectuals, always dress the part. They always look look the part. Well, this guy doesn't look the part at all. He stinks of pipe tobacco, among other things. And he has absolutely no interest whatsoever in frivolous conversation or in small talk. As I said, he's a former Presbyterian minister, but now he's a hardcore rationalist, even a practicing atheist. And for the next 2.5 years of his life, Lewis is going to be subjected to rigorous and unrelenting interrogation. Or as he says, the most casual remark was taken as a summons to disputation. And he goes on to say in his autobiography that Kirkpatrick never did soften, and that it was always a continuous astonishment to Kirkpatrick whenever anybody would not desire to be corrected or have something they said clarified. He just could not believe that people were so sloppy in terms of how they use the language and how they think. And as he told Lewis early on, you don't have any right to your opinion if there is nothing, no factual or experiential basis behind your opinion. And so this is quite shocking to Lewis. And imagine how shocking it would be in our day and time today. This Kirkpatrick is the most politically incorrect, insensitive character you could possibly encounter. But he's rigidly devoted to truth, at least truth as he perceives it. And so over time, Lewis develops the kind of intellectual muscle, and he begins to master the art of verbal defense that'll stand him in very good stead as he goes on to become a prolific Christian apologist and a prolific debater. And see, what's so providential about this is, as I said, Lewis by nature is actually not a rationalist. He's actually a bit of a mystic. And he is really, at heart, a romantic idealist. Kirkpatrick forces him to become a first-rate thinker and a philosopher. And so in Lewis, what we have is a nice integration, I wouldn't say a perfect integration, but a nice integration between the imaginative life, the creative side of life, and the sensible, rational, reasonable orientation as well. And so he can relate to Christians and communicate with Christians across a broad spectrum. And I think that's a major contributing factor as to why he is one of the most, if not the most, influential Christian of the 20th century. Now, let me just close briefly with this. This story about Lewis encountering the great Knock reminded me of another anecdote I came across years ago by the historian Eugene Genovese. Now, are any of you familiar with Eugene Genovese? What do you remember or know about him?
I believe that he's written a number of influential studies of culture.
Southern culture in particular. Eugene Genovese was actually a Marxist historian. And he had, by the way, he lives here in Atlanta, coincidentally, late in his career, late in his and his wife's career. She was also an academic. His wife got a position at Emory, and so they moved to Atlanta. Now, back in the mid-90s, about 15 years ago, both of them had a phenomenal conversion experience away from Marxism and atheism to Christianity. And but my point in mentioning Genovese is his comments on his college education when he was growing up in the 1930s and 40s. He was an undergraduate at Brooklyn College. Now, Brooklyn College, of course, now I think is part of the CUNY institution, New York, what used to be called New York University. But Genovese, and so Brooklyn College was actually never, you know, a first-rate, high-tier college or anything like that. But I'll read a brief excerpt here by Genovese and contrast the current pathology of hypersensitivity that's so prevalent today with his comments as he's reminiscing about this very rough and tumble world of higher education that he experienced as an undergraduate at Brooklyn College. Again, not a prestigious elite school, but a school that back in the 30s and 40s and even into the 50s still took education seriously. And this is what Genovese says. At Brooklyn College, which I attended in the late 1940s, everyone took for granted that students ought to challenge their professors and one another. Professors acted as if they were paid to assault their students' sensibilities, to offend their most cherished values. Now, the classroom was an ideological war zone, and self-respecting students returned the blows. In other words, they just didn't sit there passively and take the challenges and the blows. They returned them as well. In this way, we had a chance to acquire a first-rate education. That is, to learn to sustain ourselves in combat against dedicated professors who lacked the time and the tolerance to worry about our feelings. Thus, I submit that the first law of college teaching should be this. Any professor who, now, by the way, subject to the restraints of common sense and common decency, but any professor who does not seize upon every opportunity to offend, or I'd say challenge, the sensibilities of his students is insulting and cheating his students. And he is no college professor at all. Do you see the incredible contrast in the mentality back then to today, where everything has swung so much to the opposite extreme? Now obviously, as Christians, we do obviously want to operate in the spirit of Jesus Christ. We want to be sensitive to people's needs and so on. But his point, I think, is well taken, that in many respects we've swung way too far in the other direction to where now our greatest concern is with tolerance and sensitivity and not offending other people. When in fact, the great challenge in life is to encourage one another and challenge one another and exhort one another to pursue truth. And fortunately, in Lewis's life, he has people in his life that are constantly goading him, prodding him, challenging him to continue on until he eventually does find truth. And in the process, the salvation of his soul. Well, I think we've got a couple of minutes left. Any comments or questions? And then we'll come back next week and talk about Lewis's conversion per se. Yes, please.
Can you ever explain about your World War I experience and how that might have influenced?
He wrote a little bit about his World War I experience. He really didn't talk about it very much, however, and I'm not sure what to think of that. I think it was quite traumatic. Now, he was injured in the war. Couple of quick anecdotes. He's in the trenches. Now, by the way, being Irish, he didn't have to serve in the British Army. He volunteered to serve in the British Army. And he was sent to the frontline trenches. He was a second lieutenant. And he tells us that one misty morning, you could hardly see the battlefield for all the mist and probably smoke and all from, you know, earlier bombardments. He's nearly dozing off in the trench. And he opens his eyes, and all of a sudden, not more than about 10 yards in front of him, are all these gray, ghostly figures approaching. And he absolutely panics. And then he blinks and looks again. They are, in fact, Germans. And he blinks again. They all have their hands up. They're surrendering. So he takes the surrender of a couple of hundred German soldiers that morning. One other anecdote that he relates. He's standing chatting with a friend one morning in April of 1918, and a shell bursts very closely by them. It knocks Lewis to the ground. When he gets up and recovers, he looks around and sees that the man he had just been speaking to is now disintegrated. And it left shrapnel in three or four parts of his body and all. So he was immediately taken out of the frontline trenches, sent back to a convalescence hospital in London. And that was the end of his active service. He was probably in the trenches, if I remember correctly, not more than about 4 months. Okay, but he really does not write much about his World War I experience. It was pretty
terrible, and I think he was quite traumatized by it in some respects. Yes, one last.
And his occult experience, or his absorption of it, or interest in it, did he have, what sort of experience with it did he have?
I'm sorry, I missed the first part of your...
No, the occult experience.
Well, that was a rather short-lived period. Lewis had sort of been adopted by a good... When he joined the army, he made friends with another fellow, another Irishman. And this good friend of his was killed in the war. Now, Lewis was sort of adopted by this boy's mother. Her name was Janice Moore. Let's see, I sort of lost my train of thought here. Redirect me. Oh, the occult. Okay, her brother was very much involved in theosophy. And this, as I said, sort of opened Lewis, and Lewis admired this man. He was a medical doctor. He was an intelligent man. Lewis liked talking to this man about various things. And so the fact that this man was involved in theosophy had quite an influence on Lewis. Then one day they're out taking a walk together, and this fellow begins to break down, and he tells Lewis that he has had dreams and visions of being in hell, and he knew he was going to hell. And it was quite a traumatic, terrifying encounter. And Lewis had never really interacted with anybody before, in recent years at least, who even believed in hell. And this man was absolutely sure that he was hell-bound because of his involvement in the occult. And this really does have an effect on Lewis. But it's a rather short-lived period. Well, thank you very much. It,